You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I'm Wendy Dobson. I'm from the University of Toronto, and I'm delighted to introduce our last panel, which very much it's going to talk a bit about the past, but we're going to look forward to a future that is unfolding as we speak. We're all aware of the regional and the mega-regional trade and investment initiatives. We're going to talk about those within the context of China's reforms, the economic reforms, and what we've also talked about today. Now, it's difficult to see a future, an economic future, which does not have at least the possibility of the U.S. and China hopefully deepening their economic relationship as the ties that bind and perhaps raise the costs of outright conflict. The way we're going to proceed is with our three panelists who are in your program, Jeff Schott, Liu Feng, and Peter Petri. So, Liu Feng, I'm going to ask you to begin with, and each of you has 8 minutes, and then I will then lead off with some questions and some conversation, and as in the previous panels, open it to the floor. And we're aiming, boss, to have us out of here by 1 o'clock. Is that right? So, Liu Feng, would you like to lead off?
Okay. Thank you. This session mainly about the trade and investment relationships between China and the U.S. and largely with the rest of the world. I think that is the one of the very important issue for China in the coming years. I would like to talk about this issue in the three points. So first, of course, we're looking forward, but sometimes, you know, and remembering the historical lessons give us some inspirations and helps to look forward. So if you look in the past, in the China's economic reform history, initially, actually, economic reform, mainly agriculture sector, and opening up, mainly in the special economic zone, they motivated by different motivations and started relatively independently. After that, you can see a clear pattern emerged by which reform on one hand and opening up on the other hand interact very subtly and mutual strengthening. Sometimes progress in reform agenda makes China possible to open further, opening up. On the other hand, sometimes opening up has been used as a major driving force to push forward a reform agenda domestically. So in the previous sessions, we discussed a lot about Mr. Zhu Rongji's legacy. One of the legacy is, you know, to use in the opening up to further reform in domestically. After he resumed the premiership, he wanted to push forward reform, but there's a lot of resistances from various vested interests as well as ministries. Very strong indeed, especially he wanted to break up the monopoly in certain sectors, including telecommunication sector. That's a strong, you know, resistance and against his efforts. So I think one of the major factors, not all, behind the opening up, especially, you know, make a bid, a fresh bid, and to succeed the accession of WTO, is to push forward domestic reform. This is why he made a visit to this country in 1999. He offered a very attractive, very comprehensive the terms and conditions, try to have a deal with U.S. as a bilateral talks. But unfortunately, he did not get what he want because maybe the technical considerations on this country, you know, made it failed. But he did reach a very important agreement on agricultural sector, which laid the foundation to conclude Sino-U.S. bilateral accessions. I think if you're looking back, WTO accession, which has been helped greatly by Zhu Rongji's visit to this country in 1999, helped a lot to advance domestic reform agenda, you know, between the centuries, which also helped tremendously the successful development, you know, performance in the Wen Jiabao's period. That is the first one. I just want to emphasize the opening up, and also especially and to improve the healthy economic and trading relationships with the biggest country like U.S. is crucially important for China, not only for opening up of China's economic system, but also deepening the domestic reform agenda. Secondly, now we face another round of the reform and opening up. Actually, it is well discussed and also commented in the previous panelists, you know, and over last decade also, in the first beginning, in the first decade of the new century, Chinese economic development has achieved great success in a lot of aspects of economic development, but for a lot of reasons, domestically and as well as politically, so economic reform agenda has not been proceeded as quickly, as comprehensively as we expected or wished. So there's a legacy, you know, from the previous history. So imposes a very urgent task for the new leaders as well as society at large to proceed reform urgently, to break the bottlenecks of the institutional transformation, to quickly as possible to establish or complete the reform process. This is why we can see what we see. The new leaders, they put a very high priority in the reform agenda. But in order to do that, we need to further reform. So I think that presents a broad context in which China and the U.S., two biggest countries, wish to improve their relationships on an institutional basis. Okay, there are a lot of the bilateral and the regional FTR agreement negotiations are in process, but unfortunately, either TPP or RCEP are not including China and the U.S. in the same platform. So that explains why I think the two country leaders, pay a very high priority to the currently going on these bilateral investment treaty negotiations. I think, of course, that will be very challenging for China, okay, to fulfill the requirements to make may make successful conclusion of the BIT, which has been mentioned in President Xi Jinping and Obama's summit in Beijing at the end of the last year. So, but that also presents a golden opportunity to push forward the reform agenda in China. Actually, we all know that there's a comprehensive reform agenda laid out by the third plenary reform, as well as, you know, the ruling, the reform on the ruling rule to achieve the rule of law by the fourth plenary reform. So in order to do that, I think further opening up, especially negotiation with this country in terms of the BRT, and will be very helpful and provide a very positive impact on that. Thirdly, I would like to add another major area which may also produce positive impacts in the bilateral relationships between this country and China, which also helps, which also right relevant to the current subject of this session. That is the agricultural liberalization in China, which has been not focused, and but I think with a lot of potential. If you're looking back over the last decade or so, China's agricultural inputs has been growing tremendously. The total imports increased from 1.1 billion US dollars in 2000 to something like 140 billion US dollars, okay, in the year before last year, 2013, okay. Especially the soybeans, we all know that in recent years, China's annual soybean importation has been increased to the figure something like 65 million tons, five times of domestic output in recent years. It's unbelievable if you go back 20 years ago. In this country is a major trading partner in terms of agricultural trade. The imports from U.S. by China increased from something like 1 billion U.S. dollars, okay, in 2000 to something like 7.5 billion U.S. dollars. To something like 11 billion U.S. dollars the year before last year. I think it's tremendous progress because China is undergoing the urbanization and the industrialization. And because the structural factors changes in terms of the labor cost, in terms of the relative scarcity of the land resources, as well as because of the persistent and the trend appreciation of the RMB as a matter of the trend. So I think that is a structural change, also beneficial to the two countries. Because in this country, it's obviously, if you, because in recent years, the net imports by China from this country is something like 7.5 billion US dollars. If you calculate on the basis of assumption that quarter of a million US dollars proceeding of exportation will support one farm job, then you can say this kind of exports to China can create another 30,000 farming jobs. On the other hand, it's also very good for China in economic terms. It helps China in overall interests of economic development because, for example, we import the soybean, something like 65 million tons of the soybean. That is equivalent if you use the output yields in China for the soybeans. You can say that saves something like 700 million mu, which is one-third of the sowing area of China, okay, in the land. So that means, you know, we saved, we imported a huge amount of the land and water, other resources, okay, for China. That is good. But on the other hand, because the current agricultural regime is very protective in nature, so China also increased the subsidies in agriculture sector, also price interventions, produced huge gaps in the agriculture prices domestically and internationally. I just want to say China and the U.S. can make huge progress if they can have FTR to negotiate agriculture, make a mutual reform in agricultural sectors to further advance the agricultural regime, regime in this country. So, generally speaking, looking past and also looking ahead, I think the collaboration between China and the U.S. in trade and investment will be very important and have a lot of potential. Okay.
Thank you for those 3 points. Jeff?
Well, thank you very much. Very difficult act to follow after Professor Liu, and I will try to be as succinct and substantive as his comments. I also want to send the regrets of my colleague Fred Bergsten, who had hoped to join you today on this panel. He faced urgent family matters that prevented him from being in town today, and hopefully I can be as substantive, if not as provocative, as he would have been in this presentation. He was going to speak off of a new book that he co-authored, Bridging the Pacific, which is really about the topic of this panel, about how the United States and China can work more closely together for our mutual benefit going forward. The topic is a very important one, and even more so if you think back just 20 years ago, U.S.-China trade and investment relations could only be characterized as primitive. And but spurred by the political commitments to economic reform by Chinese leaders that we have been talking about this morning, China began a rapid and dynamic process of integration into regional and global markets. Of course, there was a big push in that direction with China's accession to the WTO. The United States really played a principal role in negotiating that accession in the 1990s. As Professor Liu said, this was really about complementing what Chinese leaders wanted to do at home to propel domestic economic growth. Domestic policies drove the interest and desire to complement those policies with international economic arrangements. It wasn't the international agreements driving or pressuring. I think we see a very similar process unfolding today with regard to the international economic arrangements that have been negotiated by China or in the process of being negotiated by China. This process has been evolving over more than a decade. China has negotiated numerous trade agreements, mostly with its Asian neighbors, mostly very low quality, but there has been an incremental improvement in the scope and depth of liberalization in the agreements that have been negotiated, starting from a very low base of the China-ASEAN agreement and building up to more recent agreements with New Zealand, with Australia, and the recently announced agreement with Korea, which actually hasn't been concluded yet. They're still negotiating the final parts. So the negotiations have been announced and as completed, and the negotiators will soon complete the negotiations. That said, what's included in those agreements do not drive or complement the new reforms in China very much. They are not of sufficient scope and ambition to really make a difference in the calculus of how you pace the reform, how you deal with adjustment in the Chinese economy. But the interest in working with the United States in deepening economic integration in the Asia-Pacific region could have that type of impact. And right now, if you look at all of the arrangements, as Professor Liu said, really the one outstanding characteristic is none of the existing economic integration arrangements in the Asia-Pacific region include both China and the United States. There's a reason for that. We've had very rapid growth in our bilateral trade over the past 20 years. It's grown almost tenfold from about $65 billion total two-way merchandise trade to over around $600 billion. But the bilateral trade deficit, that the U.S. bilateral trade deficit with China, has also grown substantially and now is well over $300 billion. Of course, economists at the Peterson Institute and at Brookings will tell you that doesn't matter. It's the broader current account situation. But the enduring large deficits with China do contribute to a harsh debate and scrutiny by the Congress and affect the political possibilities for deepening our economic relations. So you can say almost that there is somewhat of a mistrust in Washington about the ability of China to pursue and implement and enforce economic reforms. And there is a mistrust in Beijing about the intentions of the United States and the willingness of the United States to open up to Chinese enterprises, particularly in the area of Chinese investment in the United States. And that is a topic of current discussion in our ongoing negotiations of the bilateral investment treaty. There are some challenges moving forward, and indeed the purpose of the study that Fred Bergsten, Gary Huffbauer, and Sean Miner produced was to try to get a better, more information and greater clarity on the nature of the problems confronting U.S. and Chinese officials and enterprises, but also the great opportunities for what can be done to remove restrictions, lower transaction costs, and hopefully pave the way for more beneficial trade and investment between our two countries. The most direct way of doing so would be through a bilateral free trade agreement. And yet, while this would make sense for economists, when you factor in the political participants in both Washington and Beijing, it will require more preparation. But just thinking about it and beginning to understand that the scope of the problem in substantive terms is not as great as one would have imagined just 5 or 10 years ago, I think is very important and deserves much more attention. And I think the discussions that we've had and even the discussion on agriculture and the subsidy problem shows that there are ways of resolving this that are not as insurmountable as one would have thought just a few years ago. Now, there are various channels for doing this. There are ongoing negotiations in the Asia-Pacific. Again, the U.S. is participating in the most comprehensive one, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which talks include 11 other countries and are nearing completion. I suspect that there could be some announcement by the spring of substantial completion of the negotiations. China has been examining, Chinese officials have been examining these negotiations very carefully over the past 2 years, and U.S. and Chinese officials have been discussing them very intensively during this period so that there is a greater understanding of what is going on. I think this is an important component of our bilateral economic relationship, which sometimes is underestimated, that we now have a much deeper flow of information and consultation that avoid the misunderstandings that used to dominate our bilateral trade relationship. And this goes on in the JCCT. It goes on in the Strategic and Economic Dialogue. It goes on in the various bilateral meetings, numerous bilateral meetings that our leaders have in various forums all over the world. There are ways of dealing with this, and in a regional context as well. And indeed, China led a very important discussion of bridging the Pacific in terms of new international economic arrangements in APEC that could be supported by APEC during the year that China was the chair of APEC in 2014, and produced a number of important studies, one of which Peter Petry was a key co-author and co-editor on trying to understand what are the options going forward for U.S.-China engagement, both at the bilateral, regional, or even multilateral level. I think there are lots of opportunities, and perhaps since I've used up my time, I'll turn it over to Peter because he's got the answers.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you so much, Jeff. So, Peter, what are the answers?
Well, this has been a fascinating morning, and I really enjoyed hearing some of the anecdotes about the Zhurongji era. And it occurred to me as I was listening to this that in the international arena, in the international trade arena, we are, in a sense, at the end of the Zhurongji era. That is, the institutions that he helped to put in place, the China accession to the WTO, and the enormous increase in China's presence in the world economy that followed, were, in a sense, the product of the Zhurongji innovations that we have discussed in many different ways earlier. But today, we need a new framework. We have sort of run to the end of China's accession to the WTO, sticking with the WTO rules as they were defined really in 1994. We have run the end of that era. There are a lot of new frictions that we are dealing with and that we have to address. And we need a new framework, a new paradigm. And I think in that context, the notion of a free trade agreement that ultimately includes China and the United States and perhaps many other countries is a very, very strong paradigm. It's not going to happen soon. It's going to take an enormous amount of work, but I think one can begin to see elements of that picture emerge already today. The first point that I want to make is that the context in which we discuss these issues, the actual facts on the ground, are changing quite rapidly, and I'm not sure that our politics has quite caught up with them. From 2001 or just before China's accession to the WTO to 2007, Chinese exports to the United States grew at an annual rate of 21% a year. Since then, they have been growing at 5% a year. So it's really quite different. The U.S. exports have been growing very fast. As Jeff says, the bilateral trade deficit is still large. My guess is it will be always large due to the triangular trade that involves China, the United States, and other countries. But the speed of change has really slowed down, and we are in a maturing relationship. If you want to look at that period of the 2000s, it was when trade was opened up, as we academic economists like to say, between China and the rest of the world. Now it's a maturing relationship, growing much more slowly, and even if you look at the composition of trade, and you look at the rate at which that is changing and becoming more sophisticated, even that is slowing down. So in a sense, we are reacting to some extent in American politics, but I think also in China, to that era of extraordinarily rapid growth and change, even though in some ways that shock of China entering the world economy and becoming a very powerful part of it, even though that shock is now to a large extent behind us. China's importance is not behind us by any means, but the shock of its entering the world stage in a very rapid way, causing large adjustments also in the United States, which is what part of the political concern is about in the U.S., that is behind us. And in that process also, the old frictions, which have typically involved conventional sectors of the economy, steel wire, tires, the most recent of them was solar modules. These are sort of looking more manageable now. We have a whole new set of frictions, however, that are not so manageable. Currency belongs on that list, although for the time being, the currency problems are retreating. But cybersecurity is very much on the top of that list. I would add to that industrial policy and the various forms in which that manifests itself, including the anti-monopoly rules in China, and most of all, investment. These are what trade negotiators, some of these are what trade negotiators call the 21st century issues. These were not covered by WTO version 1994. They will have to be covered by a new set of rules of world trade as we move forward. And these are the issues that I think are on the minds of Chinese and U.S. Negotiators. I'm sure they come up at every JCCT or SNED, all of the bilateral consultation mechanisms that we have developed at all those issues, and ultimately we'll have to have a framework of rules, not so much to prescribe exactly what countries do, but more that they have a mechanism for discussing them, if possible, dispute resolution mechanisms to diffuse disagreements if they arise, and essentially be put on a kind of routine basis, much as the WTO put the sectoral issues on a routine basis. Doesn't mean full agreement. It means continuing friction. But when you look, for example, at anti-dumping rules that the U.S. applies on Chinese products, they account only for about 3 or 4% of the trade between the countries. So they are there. They're not completely put into the into the past, but they're managed. And so it will have to be with these new issues. Now, let me then turn finally to how this might be managed. I think the issue of a large free trade agreement is a very important benchmark, in a sense, a paradigm. But it is obviously not likely to be happening soon. But in the meantime, it gives rise to a series of topics that hopefully we can deal with bilaterally and increasingly multilaterally. And the BIT is perhaps the most compelling and the earliest one of those. And we might do that, as Jeff mentions, bilaterally, but probably not just bilaterally, also regionally and to some extent through the WTO plurilateral process as well. Let me close just very quickly on the FTAAP, the Free Trade Area of the Asia Pacific, which Jeff mentioned, which came up as a very prominent issue in the APEC summit a month or so ago. What was interesting about it to me, I think, from the viewpoint of reading about it in the United States, is how curiously misreported it was in the press, in that it became a kind of contest between the TPP, which the United States is struggling to complete, and the FTAAP, which China was promoting. In fact, this is an idea which several generations of APEC leaders have endorsed. Its origins, in a sense, go back to Fred Bergsten's committee in 1994, which led to the Bogor Declaration at the time within APEC. And it's an idea which George Bush, the second, brought to the APEC forum in the mid-2000s. So it's an idea in which both countries have had a long history of support. And I think it provides the outcome of the APEC meeting is actually very good. It's a 2-year study, which will presumably by then much of the TPP work will have been done. It will involve a series of studies both within and outside of the APEC process, and hopefully it can provide a roadmap for how to bring all of these issues together. Bilateral progress between the United States and China on these many issues will be very critical to setting the stage for a successful larger agreement. But such a larger agreement, particularly in the Asia-Pacific context, would have very, very clear benefits and will have shared ownership, which I think at this point is going to be pretty critical for the rules that we set for the next stage of world trade. Last thing I wanted to say is I think Ken Lieberthal earlier hurt my feelings quite a bit as an economist by saying that comparative advantage may not have been the critical issue in China's accession to the WTO and in the benefits that followed. At some level, I agree with that, but I want to defend comparative advantage. Even the economic gains from a large agreement that, for example, would stretch across the Asian Pacific would be quite large. We have been estimating that, and actually part of that is in the Bergsten volume, at about $2 trillion, of which maybe half of a more ambitious, more inclusive agreement, of which about half would accrue to the United States and China. More to China than to the United States because there are more distortions to remove, more expansion to support, but still very positive benefits to both countries. Thanks.
Thank you very much, all three, for introducing a whole range of issues. And I'm going to ask a few follow-up questions and then open this to the floor. maybe I'll start with Lu Feng and take you back to both Jeff and Peter, sort of skirting around the issues of, but very positive about the possibility of a bilateral China-U.S. Free trade agreement. And as Jeff suggests, this is a way, working towards this is a way to help resolve differences and build understanding. How do you see such an idea as relating to the reforms that you have spoken quite positively about? In the in your remarks, you talked about the bit. This would be much broader.
Yeah, I quite agree with Peter Petrie's suggestion that these two largest countries need to have sort of the bilateral talks on the institutional arrangements in the new for the new decades and the new environment. If you look at the current situation, the status quo, we see a lot of the regional and bilateral free trade agreement or the close economic relationships going on there. You know, of course, that is the result in part of the failure of the successful completion of the Doha Round. So we cannot push forward the bilateral global trading liberalization and the process. So we go to regional. But for a lot of reasons, you know, as we discussed, these two countries don't have opportunity to directly talk to each other, but they have their own agenda, you know, specific talks. In your country, you have the TPP in Asia Pacific. In our country, we have a lot of bilateral talks, but also RCEP, you know, regional talks for FTA. So as Yipin and commented in an early piece of paper, he alarmingly and commented on the situation is the risk of the, another economic cold war. Okay, maybe he just want to remind us it's not a desire and a situation. So in order to avoid that, I think we need a new talks between us directly to address all these, you know, and the emerging issues. Is quite different from what we talked and more than a decade ago in WTO accession. For example, I think this kind of talks not only can echo Sino-US relationships in a more stable institutional setting, which can be very helpful for us in the coming decades, but also, as I emphasized just now, for domestic reforms inside China. For example, China now need to streamline administrative intervention, including a lot of industrial policy mentioned by Professor Petrie. You know, the ministries or administrative agencies that intervene the economy using a lot of the international industrial policies. I think to change the situation, of course, they can have the domestic reform, but also they can combine with the opening up agenda, you know, because the new generation of the free trade arrangements, they will address broader issues like that, including the investment opportunities. We know that this country is the largest FTR, overseas development investment country, but also China emerged as a very big ODR country. Last year, ODR, total scale of the ODR, surpassed the FDR, become one of the major foreign direct investment countries. So I think talks on these areas further liberalize the environment between these two countries in terms of the direct investment will help China in this area. So I think that there's a lot of areas, direct talks between these two countries in terms of the bilateral free trade arrangements can help dearly, greatly.
Thank you. So, Jeff, you've been involved. One of the things that you may not know about Jeff is that early in the decade, starting around 2000, Jeff actually fielded a study process with Koreans, a Korean institution, on the possibility of what became, many years later, the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, CORUS. So, Jeff, why don't you tell us a little bit about the genesis of that process? And before you end, can you also give us an idea of your views on the recent China-Australia and China-South Korea free trade agreements? As you pointed out, the Korean one is not yet finished.
Yeah. Well, there are some interesting parallels, but also important differences in the experience that the United States had with Korea going back 15 years now. It was 15 years ago when I was actually asked by a senior official of the Korean government if I would examine the pros and cons or the challenges of negotiating a bilateral free trade agreement between Korea and the United States. The United States was not interested in considering it because Koreans were not going to discuss agriculture. And as I did my research in Korea, I found that almost nobody in Korea except the minister who was asking me to do the study actually was supportive of a free trade agreement because they had strong protectionist interests. But the objective of the exercise was really to find a way to instill more competition in the Korean market. So a lot of it was about how do you encourage foreign firms to invest in Korea? How do you remove the barriers to that entry as a means of spurring more innovation and productivity growth by domestic firms, but also bringing in new ideas, new technology into the country? This was really a way of saying the CORUS FTA was really about how do you open up the Korean market to foreign direct investment. Now, in the China context, we're pursuing a bilateral investment treaty negotiation. And that has been going on since 2008, and not much happened for the first 5 years, in part because of different concepts about the scope and coverage of the prospective PAC, but also because the United States was revising its model bilateral investment treaty, sort of a template for what U.S. negotiators expect their trading partners to undertake in an agreement. And this is a very high standard agreement and goes beyond the normal investment provisions of a traditional investment treaty, but includes provisions on environment and labor and the like. So it's a very high bar. This is something that is posing a big challenge for the negotiators. And indeed, it's not just a problem that China has. The United States has only concluded and ratified two bilateral investment treaties over the past 10 years. With Uruguay and Rwanda. Part of the problem is the high level of expectations of the agreement, but the other problem is the complications of the U.S. ratification process. Because as a treaty, a bit requires two-thirds vote by the Senate, so it is not it doesn't go through Congress like a free trade agreement. And many countries, including Korea, thought that a better way of proceeding was to put the investment provisions in a more comprehensive economic arrangement, a free trade agreement that covered trade and investment, and then go through the they're still difficult, but perhaps less daunting process of implementing legislation of a free trade agreement. And so that's one of the options that we have as we move forward with our investment talks with China, seeing whether this can proceed as a standalone investment treaty, or whether the experience gained and the convergence of positions can be included in other types of agreements like Peter was talking about.
And my other question, Australia and Korea, with China, how comprehensive are these
deals? Well, the texts aren't, the Korea text with China is not out yet. But without giving you a long-winded not useful answer, suffice it to say that these negotiations had a political imperative to conclude quickly by both sides. And when faced with that political imperative, the negotiators had to cut corners and push some things off the table that otherwise would have been included. So there are extensive exceptions, and in some areas where the nature of the commitment is not as comprehensive or as forceful as had originally been hoped. So they moved the process politically forward quite a bit. They moved the process economically forward a little bit.
Thank you. So, Peter, what would you prefer to see? You're the one that has done a fair amount of work on the various options, ranging from a China-U.S. free trade agreement to something more phased and more comprehensive in the sense of involving others. What do you think makes most sense as the default, I guess?
What I can give you is a kind of brief thoughts on preferences that I would have, and some of the reasons for that. I think predicting these things is very difficult, and I didn't ask you to predict. I don't think I can do that. To me, the idea of an Asia-Pacific regional agreement, which includes China and the United States, and provides a kind of umbrella that weaves all of these disparate, important economies together, is very attractive. It's attractive, first of all, politically, because it's in some ways a fragile part of the political landscape, a fragile part of the geopolitical landscape. And I think giving that group a very solid, positive-sum game, which a free trade area would represent, is not going to solve political problems, but at least it's going to tilt the balance toward solutions that I think are politically desirable. Second, this is what economists would call a natural trading bloc. We have in the economics profession a kind of debate between those people who say that trading zones or free trade areas are potentially bad because they exclude important countries, versus those who argue that, yes, they may exclude some countries, but within them they generate sufficient trade to make the benefits to the world as a whole very positive. And this group of economies, which is generally in the Asia-Pacific region, is very clearly falls into the category of blocks where internal trade creation is likely to dominate almost any other negative consequences, and we will have then the resources to compensate countries or to include countries that might be hurt by that. So it's economically a very desirable one. And finally, this is just a very important part of the world trading system. Its demonstration effects, its ability to dynamically bring other countries on board across the world to help to spread the rules that are developed in this region to the world, is very high because everybody wants to trade with them. They're a very important part of the global system. So it's I think, difficult, but there is a lot to be said for it. One important early issue that will come up is membership. The APEC FTAAP group, the 21-member group, for example, includes Russia. It's going to be a difficult country to negotiate with. It doesn't include other important Asian economies like India. But there is nothing about the APEC process that would tie such a regional free trade agreement directly to APEC in terms of membership. So it could have fewer members, it could have more members, and I think that it's a vision. It's going to take time, but I think the effort over these next 2 years to take stock of what might be possible, I think, is attractive.
My final question, so I'm coming to you, the audience, next. It's a tough one for Jeff, but short. Can you comment on how those of us outside the Beltway should understand TPP and TPA and the sequence? Because we read, I think, today's Financial Times quotes, seems to quote USTR as saying, let's negotiate it and then submit it. And coming from Canada, we don't see that as a very promising option, speaking for myself. And I think the Japanese don't either.
Okay. Historically, there has been a tension between the Congress and the executive with regard to the negotiation of trade agreements. Congress has the constitutional responsibility, but the executive branch actually executes the negotiation. What we have now is a process where we've had negotiations underway for almost 5 years. They're nearing completion. Essentially, the ministers are meeting privately on a number of occasions whenever they get together to try to resolve the remaining open issues, which have narrowed substantially over the last 6 months. Meanwhile, the Congress is now beginning the process of reauthorizing trade promotion authority, which expired in the end of June 2007. There's a substantial draft bill that was pulled together last year. And one of the co-authors of that bill is now the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, so it will move fairly quickly forward. The members of Congress use this bill to provide guidance in terms of the objectives of negotiations and the priorities and some of the red lines to put in for the U.S. In the negotiations. So it's odd to do that legislation at the end of a negotiation. I think what Congress will insist on in terms of congressional prerogative and its constitutional authority is that the trade promotion authority legislation will be advanced before the TPP is signed. Now, what that means is that the TPP and TPA will proceed in an incremental fashion. You will move forward to almost the finish line of the TPP negotiations. That will provide the content for why members of Congress should and will vote for trade promotion authority. That vote will then allow, after a 90-day notification period for Congress to review the draft, for the U.S. executive to sign the bill, and that then can begin the process of developing, implementing legislation. So it's convoluted, but one where the process could unfold relatively quickly in the second quarter of this year and lead to congressional vote before the end of this year.
So that's the positive.
That's the optimistic scenario.
Interpretation. Yeah. All right. Thank you. That's very helpful. So, yes, a question at the back, blue shirt. Identify yourself.
It's a test. Hi, David Wu, former member of Congress. And I have a question primarily aimed at Dr. Schott, but interested in other comments. And that is, I'm a former international trade and technology lawyer, and I was acutely aware that I was a beneficiary of international trade. But in Oregon, a high school graduate who has been working in industry for a long time was unlikely to benefit, and at age 50, unlikely to be retrained as a computer programmer. And I'd be interested in your comments, partially as an economist, but partially as a citizen, about what we do about issues like that. And secondly, you also recognize that trade agreements are frequently investment agreements underneath the surface. And I'm curious about why don't we characterize them as investment agreements and then have an honest public discussion about whether we want that or not.
Those are wonderful questions, and I can't do justice to answering them completely. The first thing to say, though, is that trade agreements create opportunities. They don't guarantee sales. And so we need to pursue, in conjunction with trade agreements, domestic economic policies that improve the efficiency and productivity of American agriculture and manufacturing. And we don't do a very good job of that. It also means that there will be more competition in our marketplace, though our borders are pretty open. And so whether we have a trade agreement or not, we're getting a lot of competition in that marketplace. We're not doing enough in terms of complementary economic policies to deal with that. One of the simplest things, problems to look at is the inadequacies in our investment in infrastructure, which imposes a tax on a wide range of enterprises in the United States. We're taxing our own ability to our own firms and inhibiting their ability to compete because of that. The adjustment assistance question is a much more difficult one. Because you're right, there are some areas where workers will have a hard time finding alternative employment. At some ages, you can do training or education. We're not good at programs of that, though we've had trade adjustment assistance for over 50 years. The program is well-meaning, but not well-designed. The problem for older workers is even more difficult. And I'm of that age that I'm wondering, how could I compete with the brilliant young students that I see when I travel overseas? That's a bigger problem, but it's also a general challenge to Congress and on how we share the gains from globalization, from trade, how we distribute the benefits across our society. And that's what Congress is supposed to do. And Congress hasn't done a very good job of doing that with a view towards equity and efficiency and growth in the U.S. economy. And that's been going on for a long time.
Peter, you'd like to add?
Yeah, if I could just add to that. I think we tend to frame this picture of trade in the context of the 2000s, of that decade between 2001 and just the beginning of the financial crisis. And that was a very unusual decade. It was very unusual, first of all, because China became a very powerful exporting country. It was also very unusual in the United States because we borrowed a lot and we spent a lot. We built a lot. And manufacturing was a sector that suffered from all of those combination of things. If you look at what has been happening in the last 5 or 6 years, that's not so obvious anymore. That's not happening. And the effects of that on manufacturing are certainly not as negative. And I would argue that if one looks at the next decade, that participating in a very active, aggressive, competitive international economy will be important for the United States. So we shouldn't look at it from the perspective of that pretty bad decade when imports, among other things, were the kind of dominant feature of that era.
Good point. Next question. Yes. Yes, third back from the front. Who else has their hands up? And then you with the glasses over there.
Hi, Chen Weihua, China Daily. I want to ask, you know, Professor Joseph Stiglitz wrote in the recent Atlantic Monthly basically describing TPP as a U.S. attempt to cut China out of the Asia supply chain. I want panel's take on that. I mean, obviously, the Chinese attitude has changed somewhat, official attitude. I mean, some still believe there is a conspiracy theory on the U.S. side. I mean, I can find evidence. I mean, a lot of criticism both in China and inside in the U.S. about U.S. Sort of lack of enthusiasm or maybe even opposition to sort of the China proposed Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, you know. And just second related, I want to describe how difficult it would be for China to join TPP, I mean, versus what Zhu Rongji led China into WTO. I mean, I would think, I mean, since Vietnam, which is behind China in this sort of a flying geese pattern, is going to qualify, so how China is not going to qualify. Thank you.
Jeff, this is yours.
You want to take it?
Okay. I think whether there's a conspiracy motivations or American colleagues can answer much better than me, you know. So there's a lot of discussion in China's media and academic circles, you know, about the possibility or whether how can we approach or assess the TPP initiatives in recent years. In my observation, I think there's two elements. On the one hand, I try to assume, you know, and the U.S. as the leader and the rule setter in this world, they want to, to make efforts to create a new generation of the new rules for the bilateral or regional or even global, you know, trading regime or new institutional settings. I think that is one element there. But on the other hand, I think as a part of the major part of the rebalancing strategy, it also covers elements to, you know, deal with China and to manage Sino-U.S. relationships. I think maybe also there. I read the report entitled Big Bets and the Black Swans, produced in this institution, which also mentioned this issue, you know, the TPP as a major policy instrument, as a rebalancing strategy in the new environment. But the problem is how China take their own position towards this kind of the initiative. I think even, you know, given there's two elements in there, then I think China should take a more positive approach in terms of this negotiation, because we discussed extensively there's several issues, for example, environmental protection. Maybe the standard is higher than China should take, given the development stage at the moment, which emphasized by Justin. But if we can we can touch it, then we can manage. Or on the other hand, because domestically we fail, we also feel the pressures of the environmental, the pollutions as a major domestic policy issues. So a lot of issues, a lot of the policy objectives we cannot do 10 years ago, 5 years ago. Maybe we can do now or in near future, especially the climate change issue. You know, in the past, there's also controversy or speculative about the conspiracies. But recently, I think there's a big progress in APEC summit. We two countries made a deal in this area, also in the SOE reform. Actually, we want to push forward the SOE reform per se. In the first place, I think why we cannot negotiate on that. Okay. Also, this kind of competition neutrality issues. I think all these areas, if we can talk to each other, then we can find some way on the balance which can mutually satisfy both sides, including agricultural area. Actually, you face a lot of difficulties in dealing with these issues with Japan, with Korea. China, of course, also difficulty, but I think that maybe there's a more potential, in my personal judgment, for China to make a deal in this area. Actually, that is Zhu Ji achieved in his visit in 1999 to this country, which did a great job, you know, supported tremendously of China's eventually succession of WTO deal.
Jeff, with your permission, I'm going to go to the next.
Okay. You're the boss.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Nancy Tom from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I have a question about the bilateral investment treaty. Do you guys see the possibility of an upcoming conclusion? What are the challenges you think that China and U.S. face? You mentioned Chinese investment in the U.S. How about the negative list? Like, what are the other challenges you foresee? And given the political pressure to conclude the process, do you think it might fall short in terms of the standards in the investment treaty? Thank you.
Well, the BIT negotiations accelerated about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, when China made a dramatic advance in its position to negotiate off of a negative list, basically to say that the rules would apply to activities except those specifically listed in the agreement. That argues that China is now trying to have a more comprehensive agreement that would fit more into the template that the United States has been insisting on. And that really led to a rapid progress in the negotiations. Now the hard work is underway. How do you sort through what will be accepted? Exempted from the rules, because if you don't list them, they're going to be covered. And that leads to many sensitive issues with regard to state-owned enterprises, with regard to types of investments, with regard to the process of investment, including whether you include pre-establishment rights in the agreement, which is crucial for the United States. And which China has only recently begun to include in its investment agreements. So I think there's an interest in continuing to the progress and moving quickly in the negotiations this year. I think these issues are a difficult one, and I doubt there will be a substantial watering down of the agreement as a bilateral investment treaty, because that would complicate the ratification process in the United States. So why conclude an agreement that will sit in the U.S. Senate for 10 years and not enter into force? So neither side wants to have that type of result.
Yes, Peter,
add quickly to that. Bilateral investment is very interesting, and in fact, David Dollar has done some very interesting work on this. It's low. It's far less than what one would expect between two countries the size of China and the United States. So this would be, my guess, one of the very early, very positive effects of reaching an agreement.
So, yes, sir. And then one at the back and one here, and I think that'll probably finish the session.
Maybe we can group some.
Yeah, so I'm going to take all three questions together, and we'll remember them, right? Yes.
I'm Mark Brodsky, retired CEO and physicist. I have a global question. We heard a lot today about how international pressure or excuses enabled domestic change within China, very significant change and reform. I have the reverse question. As China makes huge domestic reforms, how will that affect the international stage and the other countries?
Good question. Next one. So this gentleman on the aisle, with the blue shirt, is it? And then a young man just before the camera at the back.
I'm Wayne Morrison with the Congressional Research Service. And so my question is on contradictions. If you look at some of the surveys that the various U.S. business groups have been putting out the last couple of years, you see sort of a growing negativism about the investment climate in China. And in fact, I think U.S. investment in China is down a lot this year. And at the same time, you have China talking about a high standard bilateral investment agreement based on a negative list. So it's kind of unclear to me, why is the investment climate in China getting worse while at the same time they're negotiating this high standard agreement? I'm not quite sure why there's such a contradiction in terms of the policy they're implementing now versus what they're negotiating for.
Thank you. And then the gentleman at the back.
Thank you very much. My name is Shin Isobe with CSIS. My question is about how will the U.S. political cycle affect the bilateral economic relationship? Because usually when U.S. presidential election gets closer, U.S. takes hard line against China. So some experts are expecting that BIT negotiation will not be concluded until 2017 and Congress gets much tougher against Chinese FDI to the United States. So can they manage these political difficulties and move forward many negotiations practically? Thank you very much.
So I'm going to move to all three of you. Liu, are you ready?
Okay.
Professor Liu?
So the first question, if China reforms successfully, what's the impact on global economy? I think obviously that will be positive. I think if China economic reform goes smoothly and successfully, then productivity of China's and the catch-up will continue. Then China will be able to organize, provide more and more goods for the rest of the world at a relatively cheap price. But on the other hand, I think China can import a lot of the goods from rest of the world. That will boost the economy, you know, in the world. On the other hand, I think as China become and more and mature much of the economy, I think China can play an even bigger role and a positive role in a lot of other areas. You can see, of course, maybe there's a different opinions, but in my regard, in my observation, I think a recent efforts by China to set up these kind of the Asia independent infrastructure development banks as well as other initiatives, they can help a lot, you know, and for other countries' development, including ASEAN or other Asian countries, including even African countries, because China can do a lot of the infrastructure building there. That is the issue Justin has done a lot in recent years. So generally speaking, then China can play a more, have the more bigger confidence to play a bigger role in the international, you know, and framework setting, also creatively participate the rule setting in the world, I think. I lifted other two
the
questions.
The investment climate is getting worse, was the question. Is there a contradiction?
Yes, I think
that
is a very, how can I say, and a shocking question. I appreciate there's a lot of the discussion as well as controversies about the industrial policies in China. So a lot of some people and interpret as how can I say backward and the process in terms of investment the environment in China. I want to say, you know, maybe there's individual cases, but I'm hesitate or even have reservations about the old judgment of the overall how can I say returning, you know, back of the international investment environment in China. Generally speaking, I think as Chinese government implemented further opening up policy, pilot projects in Shanghai, experimental zones, as well as especially domestic reforms, including anti-corruption campaign. So I would like to say, even though there's still some unsatisfactory cases, the overall environment, maybe at the margin where it has been improved and will be improved in future. So also, on the other hand, I think Chinese negotiation with U.S. in terms of the bilateral investment treaty, if they make progress as expected, for example, if the in the February, if China can deliver quality shortlist, negative list, then and put the momentum going on, I think that will tremendously improve, further improve of the environmental investment environment. So I think maybe that is the issue subject to further observation and discussion.
Thank you so much. Jeff, you have about a minute.
Well, on the U.S. political cycle, as you know, Wendy, politicians like to say nasty things about our trading partners. So lots of nasty things about Canada and Mexico have been said over the years, Japan and now China. But the U.S. electorate, the people who vote, don't care very much about international events. And they vote basically on domestic issues and domestic concerns. And so we even saw when Obama was fighting for the Democratic nomination in 2008 against Hillary Clinton, they were very nasty comments about NAFTA. But by the time you got closer to the election, people weren't talking about NAFTA or anything in the in international trade. They were
but
talking.
But we didn't forget.
So I think you'll hear more nasty things close to the election. But in terms of affecting the bilateral economic relationship, I think it's being conducted by adults, and it will move forward.
Peter, you get the last word.
Well, very, very, very quickly, this is a huge relationship. This is the world's biggest trading relationship. These are the world's two largest economies. It's going to be competitive as well as complementary. So I think some of these questions about, for example, TPP as kind of laying down the markers for rules that the United States would like to see in the world, yes. I mean, I don't think one needs a conspiracy theory to understand that, in fact, the U.S. is trying to help define those rules for the future through the actions it takes. But these are also the two economies that I think in the long run have the most to gain from a system in which rules are fairly predictable and in which open trade and investment is permitted and is fair, reasonably fair across the world. So we have to be pragmatic. We have to take the competition at its face value and ultimately try to bring these rules about that help us both do well in the long run.
Very good advice on which to end. So on your behalf, I would like to thank Professor Liu, Jeff Schott, and Jeff Schott, by the way, for leaping into the breach at very short notice, and Peter Petrie. This was a very revealing, if rather technical, at times, discussion. And on your behalf, I'd like to thank them all. Thank you.